He lied. He lies a whole lot. Bob Wessel is the only man alive that's sober that Juanita sponsors. The rest of them that she took on drank. And I'm sure I don't have to tell you why. I was down there Thursday night for the meeting, and then some of them were talking about driving down there and had God in the car with them. I told them when Bob pulled up in the driveway that we put God in the back seat with Juanita and Gay. About 10 miles down the road, he got out. We caught up with him, tried to get him back in the car, and he wouldn't get in. So we come down there without him. My name is Jack Sullivan. I am an alcoholic. Amen. Come from Louisville, Kentucky. My sobriety date's the 21st day of August of 1962. My home group is the South Louisville group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Meets on Wednesday nights, an open speaker meeting. If you're ever in Louisville, I hope you come by and see us. I think it's the finest home group in the world. If you don't have a home group, I suggest you get one. If you got one and you don't think yours is the best one in the world, then my advice to you, just stay there. Don't go screw up somebody else's. You're probably right where you belong. I never married till I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. Most of y'all have met Gay during this weekend. She was up here reading at the Al-Anon meeting, and so I married Gay after I got sober. So I never had a wife before I got in here. I almost got married one time. I was engaged to a young lady, and Bob was not lying to you. I come by their house one time, and he was in the kitchen table, and the windows were up, and Juanita was giving him that Al-Anon handshake in his face and using profane language, and and I went home and called that girl up and canceled that engagement. I thought, by God, if that's what it's like, I don't want any part of marriage. So I put it off till after I got here. And that's the truth. I wouldn't lie from this podium. Now, there are some alcoholics that lie, I've been told. I've never met too many of them, but my wife don't believe a whole lot of things people tell her. I think the most embarrassing moment in my life was one night she called Billy Moore a liar. Billy Moore was our state delegate. And those of you, and many of you in here knew Billy, he would not lie. Well, you decide for yourself. Billy Moore told me a story that was true about an Al-Anon woman who kept coming to Al-Anon, coming to Al-Anon, coming to Al-Anon, and the husband kept drinking and drinking, and he finally died. And she had the body cremated and mixed his ashes with some marijuana and smoked him. And she went all over the country telling people that's the first time in 25 years that sucker ever made her feel good. Yeah. And that's a true story. And I know it's true because Billy told me. I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous against my will, like many of you. Had no desire to be here when I got here. But they made me go, and so I came. And I'll assure you that I've never regretted it. We've certainly had a great time since we've been here, and like I said, we came in Thursday and had a meeting Thursday night over in one of the rooms, and then Friday and today, and listening to Joe and Betty, and we're going to hear Leon in the morning, and it's just been a great weekend for us. I heard somebody say these were spiritual retreats, and I'm sure that's true. But, you know, most everything I know, I was taught by some guys in AA. I was blessed to the fact that I came to AA when I did, because there was a lot of wise old scholars in AA. They were men of a lot of simplistic origin. They truly believed in Dr. Bob Smith's philosophy of leaving the Freudian complexes to the scientific minds. They have no place in here. They were disciples of the first 164 pages with an understanding that Alcoholics Anonymous didn't need anything else, didn't need any other dimensions tied to it or anything else. And so all of their answers and ideas and beliefs were very, very simple things. And as I'd worked through the steps over the years, I was talking to an old fellow out of St. Louis, Missouri, by the name of Paul Keebler, who I'm sure many of y'all knew Paul, and he was a dear friend of mine. And I said something to Paul one time, talking about the 12th step of A, and I said, you know, having had a spiritual awakening, I'm not sure that's occurred in my life yet. And Paul said, well, I'm sure it has if you've worked the other 11 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. In order to have a spiritual experience, a spiritual awakening, the only thing you need to do is to recognize there's somebody else that lives on this planet besides you. That you step out of that self-willed run riot. And you realize in your heart, and that's where it counts, that Almighty God and other people live on this planet. And you try to live your life in accordance with the will and the belief of God and other people in yourself. When you do that, you have a spiritual awakening to the fact that all three of you must survive down here. And if you want to have spiritual growth in AA, you have to constantly improve the bond that you have with yourself, with other people, and with Almighty God. You know, and I think we all do that when we come to things like this or go to AA meetings or any other conferences. I sometimes sit in amazement when they'll introduce a Sunday morning speaker as a spiritual speaker. You know, when I've heard all the ones I've heard all week were, you know, they do exactly that very thing. And I've always been able to accept that, and I've always been able to accept the fact that the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are truly a design for living. And when I came here, I had no design for living. And I was blessed to sit around with a bunch of old people. They were godsends to most people. And it's a shame a lot of them aren't alive today. It's sad that maybe some of you young fellows never get a chance to meet some of them old guys. Because they were characters, boy. They really were, you know. And so, and fun, God, they were fun. Everywhere you went, it was fun. Everybody's face was sober, you know? Yeah. Did you see, people in AA today, they're sober, but nobody told their face. You know, they're so sad looking, you know? And they're always working on something, you know? Always doing something, you know? And they're finding other dimensions that flit around AA, those victimized programs, you know, where you're always a victim. And the greatest news about that is you'll never be happy. You cannot be a happy victim. You know, it's an impossibility. It is no way could ever conform to AA's philosophy. You know, AA says accept responsibility for who and what you are. There may have been a lot of situations in your life you didn't create them, but how you reacted to them, you have to be responsible for that. You know, and for some reason, a lot of them want to try to infiltrate this organization. I have no idea why. They're always an alcoholic and a something. You know, it's quite popular to be an and a. You know? And I sometimes introduce myself as being an alcoholic and a abused adult spouse of an Al-Anon. But I don't know why people think those kind of programs are intertwined. You know, Still never understood it. AA's been very generous. It gave its programs, its philosophy to anybody that ever wanted them. Overeaters, gamblers, narcotics. It's worked well for all of those people who recognize the singleness of purpose of their own groups, realizing the secret and the key to the whole thing was people's ability to identify with each other, recognizing the responsibility of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you advertise it as such, keep it as such. And if you respect AA, you respect its principles. So I really don't understand it sometimes. AA, everything they've given, everybody's worked for all those programs. Well, that's not really true in a way. It didn't work for Prostitutes Anonymous. It did for a while, but when it got to that part where it says in order to keep it, you got to give it away. It kind of went downhill from there on in. But I'm just glad to be a part of it and glad to have known those people. I could stand there for hours and tell stories that some of those old guys were such hilarious. Guys, you know, years ago, the John Hopkins University wrote 20 questions to ask you if you're an alcoholic. When those 20 questions came out from John Hopkins University, an old guy from Tyler, Texas, by the name of Wino Joe Leach, got madder than hell when he read them things. And he wanted to know why any psychologist had the audacity to start writing questions to ask alcoholics if they were alcoholics. He said, they don't mean a damn thing and never read them. And somebody said, well, you got to have something. Joe said, well, then I'll write some. Yeah, I'm serious. I've got the paper at home that they were written on. And Joe set out to write questions to ask you if you was an alcoholic. One of them was, have you ever had the roof of your mouth sunburned? Have you ever been run over by your own car while driving? Have you mastered the art of puking out of a moving vehicle without it blowing back in? And he wrote all them things, and he said, hell, he didn't need anybody to tell him what the hell they were, alcoholic. The interesting thing about that, when you're standing at the podium going through them, people in the audience are going, yeah, yeah. They're identifying, so to speak. But they were great old guys, and I thank God every day I had an opportunity to meet a lot of them. I never set out to become an alcoholic. It's nothing I've accomplished. I came from the worst place in the world to raise an alcoholic. It was a good Christian home. Seems like that's where most of them come from. I don't know what that is or why that happens, but it just seemed like it does. And I had an older brother and two younger sisters who did well in life. They had no problems. My mother was a very sickly lady. I never remember my mother being well. My mother was sick from as far back as I can remember till the day she died. She had some sort of a rare blood disease, and it eventually killed her when I was about 19 years old. So my mother is not really a big part of my story, and she never really played any important role in my life that I can recall. I never recall ever having any of those feelings of inadequacy and all that stuff that some people go through and endure. And for the first, till I was 14 years old, I don't recall any problems in my life. I was a good student and I made good grades. And when I was 15 years old and I was a sophomore in a Catholic high school in Louisville called St. X, at the end of that sophomore year, they asked me not to come back. And it was primarily because of my behavior patterns and my attitude. And my life had taken on a tremendous change. I'd gone to work in a Gulf filling station at 3rd and Central. Now, that corner borders Churchill Downs Racetrack. If you've never been to Louisville, if you ever see the Churchill Downs Racetrack, it borders 4th and Central. And 3rd and Central being a block away, there was a lot of special activities that went on around there. And at the age of 15, almost 16, I went out there at night and got a job in a Gulf filling station, working with an older boy, and it was my first experience outside the house. I had no idea what went on in that outside world. I was contented to be where I was till I found out what the hell they did out there. You know, and I thought, man, that was exciting when I got there. Everything was rationed. World War II was just about over, but was still going on. So everything was rationed, including gasoline. And people would come in there at the end of a month and leave you with gasoline ration coupons they didn't use, and they'd give them to the station operators, and we in turn would send them off to Washington, which meant we had a lot of gas in those tanks that we could now sell without ration coupon. The coupons had done been turned in. There was guys that owned whiskey stores and beer joints around there that didn't had big automobiles and had two or three Cadillacs in their garages, and they had a lot of good whiskey and good beer back during the war that you couldn't buy over the counter, but they didn't have any gasoline. So they came in that filling station, we filled those cars up, and they left good whiskey and good beer there. We put it in a storeroom we had there, and we either drank it or sold it, and that's literally where I learned to drink. There was a guy that ran a drugstore over there, and he didn't have any gasoline for his big cars, but he had the good cigarettes, and you couldn't buy them over the counter. He had the Luckies and the Camels and the Chesterfields, and he brought them over there, and we filled the cars up with gas, and he left the cigarettes. And we put them in a storeroom back there, and we either sold them or smoked them. And that's really where I learned to smoke. And there was some girls around there that didn't have any gasoline. You'll have to draw your own conclusions. And I met a lot of people that were on the racetrack that were friends of the guy that owned that place and friends of a priest that was down at Holy Name Church and that I had knew and met. And so, you know, at the age of about 15 or 16 years old, I was hanging around that filling station and around that racetrack, and I had money in my pocket. I was drinking, smoking, sexually active, and to hell with everything else I'd ever heard about. I loved everything in the world about it, that atmosphere. I didn't care anything about school anymore. I'd get out of school, dash home, throw the books down. If my mother was able to grab me, she wouldn't make me sit down and do homework before I left. Most of the time she wouldn't. Out the back door, I'd go to that corner. When I'd get home, my father would give me hell for where I was, how long I was staying, who I was with, and what I was doing, and I didn't give a damn. When the school asked me not to come back, I finished my high school education at a vocational school there at Aaron Strait. And I was still living with him. And when I graduated from high school, I stayed out at that corner. And my whole life evolved around that corner and everything that went on around it. And my father would try to stop me from doing the things that I was doing and because of the people that I was with. And he understood there's a price to pay when you act like that, and he didn't want me there. And I didn't much give a damn what he wanted. You know, I always tell people I was born in raised around 4th and Central, and for me, that's good English. I made that statement one time at Our Lady of Peace Hospital, and my stepmother corrected me. She said, don't use improper English behind the podium. Don't tell people you were born and raised. Tell them you were born and reared. She said, anything that's raised has absolutely no intelligent form of life, and my father said, leave him alone. He knows what the hell he's talking about. And that's the kind of relationship that I had with my dad. My brother had accepted a scholarship from General Motors Tech, and one of them was offered to me, and I turned it down. My two sisters were living normal lives of, you know, whatever that they were. They were good girls, both of them. And then there was me, so all the battles in the household encompassed between me and my father. I didn't much give a damn what he thought and didn't care, and we eventually became bitter enemies. I didn't like him, and he didn't like me. I told him so, and he told me so. When I was 20 years old, the best I can recall, I was arrested for the first time in my life for drunken disorderly conduct. I was now drinking too much. I was getting drunk and getting in trouble from the drinking. And I never recall that before I was 20 years old. But for the first time when I was 20 years old, I was arrested for public drunkenness and disorderly conduct, and I was sitting in jail. That's a fascinating thing about alcoholics. It seems like squad cars and jails breed humility in us. I don't know why that is, but it seems like the breeding ground of humility is the backseat of a squad car. You know, and I'm sitting in jail, and I didn't have anybody else to call, and I tell this story because it just shows you what kind of man my father was. My father believed if you're looking for a helping hand, it's on the end of your own arm. His regrets were later, and he lived for 8 years in my sobriety, and his regrets were that neither one of us knew where to put that arm. I knew nothing about AA or alcoholism, and neither did he. He thought it was self-willed run riot, and I was doing the things I wanted to do and didn't much give a damn what the penalty was. I'm not so sure at that time I wasn't that way. But he didn't believe in paying if you danced. You know, there's an old saying, if you dance to the music, you pay the fiddler. He wouldn't do it. And he was a strong enough willed parent not to do that for a child. Now, I know a lot of people that know you ought to do that, and they just can't do it, and that's understandable, too. Not my father. First time I was ever arrested, I was in jail, and I called him. He went from a dumbass old man to daddy. You know how we are when, you know, you go down here tonight, some joint and listen to that guy talk about that old bitch he lives with. Lock him up. He'll drop a quarter in the phone, she'll answer, and he'll say, honey. Yeah, you know, jails have a effect on your opinions of other people. It just, But I dropped a dime in the phone, and he answered, and I can hear him as if it was tonight. I said, Daddy? Daddy? He said, what do you want? I said, I'm in jail. He said, why in the hell did you call me? I said, well, I thought maybe you'd come down here and get me out. Oh, he said, I wouldn't worry about that if I was you. Well, I was worried about it. And I said, you know, well, I'm here. Well, he said, don't worry about it. As smart as you are? Oh, he said, I'm sure if you figured a way to get in, you'll figure a way to get out. And he hung up. And when I got out, I ran into him somewhere, and he told me, he said, I've never been in jail, but understand they give you one phone call. If I was you, I wouldn't waste it. Well, I never called him anymore. He didn't seem to have a grip of the understanding that was necessary for people like me. He sure as hell wouldn't come down there and get you out. I drank for 13 more years. And I tried every way in the world not to get worse, but we all do. I'd gone to work for the Louisville Nashville Railroad Company in Louisville when I was 20. And 11 years later, when I was 31 years old, they fired me. I had a sense of irresponsibility and undependability and didn't seem to care about anything except my own self-will. I did what I wanted to do when I wanted to do it without any regards for anything or anybody else. Even when I had that job, I'd disappear for a week or two. I ran around with a lot of people that had show horses and they'd want to go somewhere and stay a week. I'd go with them. I just didn't care. I don't know how you develop that kind of attitude, but I sure as hell developed it. And I didn't know anything about alcoholism. And everywhere I went, and the worse I got, everybody told me the same thing. If you don't quit drinking, what's going to happen to you? And it's a blessing when you get to Alcoholics Anonymous and you finally looking and dealing with a program that addresses the fact of what happens to people like you and I after we quit drinking. That we're here to learn how to live, not to learn how to quit drinking. We're here to learn how to live and not how to drink. And my whole problem at that time in my life revolved around the fact of the way that I was sober. I couldn't tolerate the world. The book said I was restless, irritable, and discontented. I guess that's good enough for me. I don't have any quarrels with that. But it seemed like that when I would get back on my feet and things going my way, I just couldn't stay away from that corner and what went on there, and I wanted to be a part of it. I was determined to go there and not drink. And eventually I would go there and just have a few. And then eventually I would go there and be right back in the same damn boat I had been in before, previously. And the only thing is, I was getting older and it was getting worse. Yeah. And the more people that I ran into that tried to help me, the only thing they could tell me was what was going to happen to me if I didn't quit. A priest told me one time I was going to hell. A policeman said I was going to jail. A judge says I'm going to the penitentiary. A boss says the unemployment line. A wife says the divorce court. A doctor that was was in AA, that was a joke. Dr. Stanton, when I was in St. Mary Elizabeth Hospital one time suffering from some of my serious maladies, that the doctor that was giving me all of this advice, and my father was sitting there in a chair beside the bed, and the doctor said, if he don't quit drinking, he's going to die. And my dad said he won't quit drinking. The first AA meeting I ever went to out on the street, he was the chairman, that doctor. I thought, damn, if that wasn't a blind leading the blind. He's sitting there telling me what I ought to do. But we had many a good conversation in Alcoholics Anonymous after that, because, you know, as I said to Dr. Stanton, that if you don't quit drinking, you die. What needed to be addressed in my life at that time, what happens to me when I quit drinking? You know, if I quit, you condemn me to live in a world of existence where I'm very unhappy. I don't live sober. I exist sober. I don't have a design for living. And if you send me out there just without booze, I don't do well. I never did do well. I lived in a world of isolation of my own mind. That's a bad place to go. A friend of mine told me one time to quit thinking. He said, your mind's like a real bad neighborhood. Never go in there alone. And I was the world's worst for that. But if you don't quit drinking, you die. And I said to Dr. Stanton, but if I do quit drinking, I'm condemned to exist in a world where I don't do well. If I drink, I die. And if I quit, I exist. There's got to be something else, something better, something in between. Little did I realize it was Alcoholics Anonymous, where I could live happy, joyous, and free. And I didn't know anything about it. So I left there and I went back naturally, and I tried not to be that way anymore, and I was, and I tried not to drink anymore, and I did. And I just kept getting worse and worse and worse, and I finally lost my job with the railroad, and all the friends and people that I'd had over the years were gone, and I lived in the city streets of Louisville, and for close to 2 years I was a wino living in an alley, in the same place basically at 4th and Central, with nothing else to do but try to exist in a society. I've never regretted that. I tell people all the time, it's the greatest life in the world, and it's the best life in the world for people. And the reason I say that was I was a single wino living in a city street. I had no wife, I had no children, I had no family. I went to live in a city gutter. I've seen so many of you go out and get a gutter and bring it home with you. I've seen some of the stinkingest, filthiest gutters running down through the middle of some of the living rooms of the finest homes in the country. I've seen alcoholics in their sick minds, honestly to God, believing the people that loved them the most were in some way responsible for what they've become. I've seen them reach out of their living room gutters and drag beautiful wives and husbands and children and parents through that stinking emotional mess of garbage that alcoholism breeds. And we teach them well. We teach them how to be lonely and afraid, unhappy and insecure, at the same time thinking the same conditions that we're under they are responsible for. It's a sick, sick thing. Alcoholism is a tragic illness in a way, primarily because it kills a lot of people that don't even have it. And I never had to endure that. I always believe it's a lot easier to go live in a gutter as a single childless wino than it is to go get a gutter and take it home with you. Never knew anything about A, never heard of it, wouldn't have helped me. I know it wouldn't help me, it's not a hypothetical statement. I absolutely know that Alcoholics Anonymous would not help me because I could not learn from other people. Some people can. If you sponsor people like I do, and you almost know intuitively whether you're talking to somebody who is willing and has the ability to learn from others or who's going to demand that they have it their own way, you know, learn their own way. And that's the way that I was. I could not learn from other people, and I would have had to endure what I had to endure had I known about you, because I was just not teachable. I just not could learn from others. I was sharing that, talking one time with a doctor friend of mine up in Louisville and years ago, and I was telling him, I said, you know, I couldn't learn from other people. I just couldn't do it. And he was telling me, shared a story with me about a lady who had a Polly parrot who was a foul-mouthed bird, just cussed all the time. And she couldn't do nothing with it, and she got mad at the parrot one day and grabbed him and threw him in a freezer. And after the bird was in there for a while, she felt sorry for him, opened the door and let him out. And the bird about froze to death. And she said, "I'm so fed up with you the way you curse. Will you ever learn to quit?" The parrot said, "I'll never cuss again as long as I live." He said, "But tell me, what'd that turkey do?" And the interesting thing about that, the parrot learned from the turkey, right? And I know that tonight, sitting in this room, there's some parrots, some of the newer ones. You know, there's some of you that can learn from other people, and you'll do well. I also know sitting in this room are some turkeys. Yeah. And some of you sitting in here, they'll have to skin you, wrap you, and freeze your ass before you'll ever learn anything. Yeah. And I want you to know you're looking at the biggest turkey of them all. Yeah. We lived in our cardboard condominiums back in that alley. there was a hardware store that back in those days there wasn't any Dempsey dumpsters, and they threw out all those cardboard boxes, and there was an L-shaped building there, and we'd drag them over there and sleep in them. And cardboard's a great insulator. If you got any more drinking to do, you might want to write that down. It really does. It'll shield you from the elements, and I'm serious, it's good. And you can be a snob wino occasionally if you go out there early, you get one of them big freezer boxes, and you know, you can lay down in them, and you're looking at some guy trying to curl up one of them old TV console boxes. You kind of knew you was better than he was. ought to get him out, or he's ruining the neighborhood, you know. That type of thing. Meet some strange people in those alleys, really. Policemen for one, yeah. There was three of the policemen on that corner that used to arrest me all the time. Two of them are now dead, but both of them died sober in AA. One of them just recently. And they used to laugh about me, you know, and hell, they were bigger drunk as I was, but they had on uniforms that didn't count. But they were so stupid, you know. They ride down that alley in them damn big cars and five-cell flashlights and throw a light in a cardboard box at a wino and ask him what he's doing. I'm serious, and you'd stick your head out of that box and say nothing, and they'd lock you up. And I told Ray Craig and Eddie both, I said, I wished one day back then I'd have known about alcoholism. You threw that damn light in my eyes and asked me what the hell I was doing, and I could have stuck my head out of that box and said, "Officer, I'm progressing." And I was, rapidly, rapidly. When you stop and think about it, and you're nuts because you're drunk, you often wonder what the hell those people's problems are. You know, I mean, there was a guy in my finance company hunting me. He couldn't find me for a year. I borrowed some money from him, so it's a long story. But anyway, I had $472 that they gave me, and then eventually I think it wound up being $8,000 or something. You know how they are, but they couldn't find me. And finally, a bartender squealed on me and told that collector, said, "Look back there in that jungle of cardboard. He'll probably be back there." Here he comes snooping around there one day, and he saw me sitting in a freezer box. It was upright, and so was I. And I had a bottle of wine and a three-day-old racing form. And, you know, here's a guy with a suit and a tie. You can tell he don't belong back there. And he spied me in that box. You could tell he was nervous and edgy. He didn't really feel comfortable being there, and he didn't really want to do anything, I don't think. But finally he got up enough nerve, and he came over to where I was, and he knocked on my box. And, you know, I opened a flap to let him in, and he asked me if I was Jack Sullivan. I told him yes, and he said the dumbest thing I have ever heard in my life. Have no idea even to this day what he meant. He told me, he said, "You know, you borrowed some money from us and haven't paid a damn dime on it." Yeah. He said, "I'm going to tell you something. If you don't start making some payments on that loan, you're going to be in a hell of a lot of trouble." Now, Now, if you know what he meant, you let me know, Anthony, because I sure the hell don't. I sure the hell don't. And I got out of that through the help of an LNN lawyer who hated finance companies. And I didn't even know any of this was going on when it was all settled, but he went to see him, told him I was going to declare bankruptcy. Yeah. And so help me God, I was sitting in a nut house in Hopkinsville, Kentucky at Western State Hospital. And my dad was telling him about this, him and my dad went to this finance company, and this lawyer told him, said that he's going to declare bankruptcy. You give me the note, we'll give you $472 or you get nothing. Well, naturally, they took it. And Harry Britt was the lawyer. And Harry told me, said that president of that finance company shook his finger in my dad's face. And he said, I'll blackball that boy. He said, he'll never borrow another damn nickel from a finance company as long as he lives. And Harry said, your dad looked at him and said, I certainly hope so. And that's been 33 years ago, and up to this point, he's been right. But anyway. But, you know, living a life or an existence like that is really, you know, it's really nothing to talk about. It's just hustle and you hope you get enough to drink to put your mind to sleep. They call it drinking for oblivion, and that's what you hope for. You know, because you reach a point in your life where you know every day will be like today. Nothing will ever be any better. And it's just sort of a survival and an existence. And the greatest thing in the world is when you don't have to think. On the morning of the 21st day of August, I was sitting in the back room of a saloon on that corner called the Downs Cafe. And the owner was a friend of mine. Occasionally, he'd let us in. It was sort of a cold August morning and raining. And I was sitting at a table with a bottle of wine, looking like the wrath of God. I had long hair and a beard. All my teeth had been kicked out. I was suffering from malnutrition and dehydration. I was bloated, and you turn two or three different colors when that happens to you. The back door of that saloon opened, and my father walked in with a man I had never seen before in my life. And I didn't want my dad to see me looking like that. And you know, even though you got that macho image in yourself for a while, and I don't know that he knew I was where I was and doing what I was doing. He told me later he didn't have the slightest idea I looked like that. He couldn't believe it when he saw me, and he said it was even hard and difficult to recognize you. But the man that was with him had on a suit and a tie. He was a fine-looking man, and some of the people in this room knew Jack Dawes. He always had a smile on his face. He was always very well-dressed. And if you looked at him, you'd have thought he was the president of a bank. He just had that distinctive air about him. Wonderful, wonderful man. And I had no idea who he was. My father went over and sat on some stools that went around a lunch counter, and a guy with him came to the table where I sat and stuck his hand out, wanted to shake hands with me. A man who looked like he did to come to a place like that to see somebody like me. It just doesn't make any sense. He said, hi, my name is Jack. I understand, so is yours. He said, I've come out here to help you. I'm a friend of your father's. I'd like to help you. I hope you'll let me, he said. I can't help you if you won't let me. That has nothing to do with Skid Row or the back room of saloons or strangers. It has everything to do with everybody. I can't help you if you won't let me. I've never known anybody that got help that you wouldn't let me. But I was dumbfounded at this kind of a conversation with a man like that, you know. And I looked at him and I said, why, you know, why, stranger, would you want to help me? I don't even know you. Why would you come here to see somebody like me? And he said, I've come because I used to be like you are, and somebody helped me, and that's why I'm here. I used to be like you are, and somebody helped me, and that's why I'm here. That's why I'm here. I go to 5 AA meetings a week in Louisville. That's why I go. I go because I know that in order to keep what I have, I must share it with people. I know that if I intend to try to be grateful, then I have to remember that day when a man offered to help me because he used to be like I was. And I know that maybe in some small way I can be instrumental in the lives of other people. I can understand tonight the extreme amount of gratification he got in his heart to come to a place like that to see somebody like me. And the only reward that he ever wanted was to see me once again smile and to live and to love. That was his payback for coming to do what he did, because somebody had did it for him, and that was their payback. But he was a smartass, like all them old fools were. He said, "I've made arrangements to have you admitted to Our Lady of Peace Hospital in Louisville, Kentucky, a psychiatric institution." That was fortunate you could get an alcoholic any place then. They didn't let alcoholics in places. They didn't call you alcoholics. You were drunks and drunken SOBs, you know. In a saloon, calling somebody the son of a bitch is a profanity. In an Al-Anon meeting, it's a descriptive adjective. I just thought I'd tell you that. I said, "You want me to go to that hospital looking like this?" And Jack Dawes looked at me and he said, "Well, certainly not. Do you have some place to change?" You know, he knew I didn't have any place to change. Yeah, and this is one of them smart sponsor remarks. You know, "No, do you have some place to change?" You know, "You son, you know." I didn't have any teeth and had that hair and filthy, dirty, you know, and bloated from malnutrition and dehydration, and you're green and yellow, and oh God, you'll hear them nurses the way they talked about me later on, but it was pitiful, pitiful. But it, you know, you couldn't get an alcoholic anywhere. You couldn't get an alcoholic in another room. Sometimes they might take it in an emergency room if you were laying on the street and suffering from DTs or hallucinations or something. Didn't have any detox units. The old General Hospital in Louisville, they would wheel you into one of those cubicles on those meat wagons. And if you lived, they would wheel you out. And if you didn't, I don't think it mattered. They thought you were a burden on taxpayers, people like me, for the simple reason if they wasted their talents to get you well, you would be back in the same boat in 3 or 4 days. And what the hell difference did it make? And you know, I'm not so sure they were wrong about people like me. But I know they were wrong about people that, like, I could become, you know, if given the opportunity. And back in those days, nobody gave you the opportunity. It's strange that Alcoholics Anonymous was as anonymous as it was. You know, it'd been in existence for 27 years, and yet you never heard about it. And you never saw too many people that really knew anything about it. And it was almost a competitive game back then between medicine, psychiatry, religion, you know. Nobody ever thought about treating body, mind, and spirit collectively like AA does. If a doctor got a hold of you, it was a medical problem and disgusting one at that, really. And if a psychiatrist got a hold of you, it was a deep underlying emotional problem, yeah. Very depressive problem. If a minister got a hold of you, it was a moral problem, you know, and they wanted you to try to be saved by an intangible spirit of something you didn't believe in or couldn't get a hold of anyway. And they never collectively tried to treat something. And really and truly, when Alcoholics Anonymous came along in that era, it was almost as if it was a competitive thing to these people and was treated as such for a great long time. But I was admitted to that psychiatric hospital, and that was an interesting fiasco. All the psychiatrists, I think Joe said it last night, they thought all alcoholics suffer from a Valium deficiency. Long before General Electric ever thought of it, they knew you could live better electrically. They put them electrodes on your head and buzz you with that stuff, you know. They were to clear away the ruts of your mind. That's what depression was. You know, you dig a rut in your mind so deep you can't come out of it, and they jar it out of you. You know, and they say alcoholics are depressed people. No. Yeah, some of the damn stuff we did depress a rhinoceros, you know. And then they believed something I thought was real silly. They wanted you to go to group therapy with other people Who in the hell ever heard of an alcoholic going to group therapy with other people? Alcoholics go to group therapy by themselves. You know. Why, who among you hadn't done it in your own car? Riding down the street and have a damn committee meeting. Think I'll stop in there and get a beer? You better not. Why? You know what happened last night? Yeah, but it'll be different this time. Yeah. This won't happen no more. She's going to raise hell. I don't care what she does. You got a running damn conversation going on with seven people. Ain't nobody in the damn car but you. And you think, oh, we're going to group. I'll get in the closet. That's all you really needed. And strangely enough, on the 21st day of August of 1962, Alcoholics Anonymous went into that hospital, that psychiatric hospital. The first AA meeting was to be held that night. And Bob's sponsor, a man by the name of Bill Wallace, and the guy that came and got me out of the alley, Jack Dawes, they had been trying to get AA in that hospital for quite some time. And an administrator there named Sister Catherine Mary and one psychiatrist named Louis Fultz wanted AA in there, and they finally worked it in. They finally got one meeting a week on Tuesday night into that hospital. And Jack was involved with a lot of things in Frankfurt trying to help alcoholics, and Bill was involved with a lot of things in the city trying to help alcoholics. So they turned that AA meeting over to a man by the name of Jim Kershon and three other people to help him. But it went in there that night. Now, I didn't make the first one. But on the 28th day of August, I was sitting back in my room, and a nurse from the hospital came back and gave me that Al-Anon handshake, and she was in Al-Anon. Marguerite Hughes was her name. She said, "Don't you go anywhere tonight. We're going to the AA meeting." I said, "What in the hell is an AA meeting? I never heard of AA." She said, "It's a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous." I said, "Are you insinuating you think I'm an alcoholic?" Yeah. Now, you know, that had nothing to do with Skid Row. You know, I realized later, many years later, that people tell you they're not alcoholics for the simple reason it means that alcoholics are people that have problems they can't handle. And somebody who is not an alcoholic is somebody that does not need help for what's wrong with them. I ain't no damned alcoholic, and what that statement means is whatever in hell is wrong with me is your fault. And if I am responsible for it in some way, I'll take the corrective action and it won't happen again. But I'm not an alcoholic if you anticipate me reaching out somewhere besides myself for the solution to what's going on in my life. Alcoholics are people who need help with their problem, and I sure as the hell am not one of them. And that's what I told her. I said, "I'm no damned alcoholic." And that nurse looked me straight in the eye and she said, "If you ain't one, there ain't any." And I said, "Well, that may be your opinion, but I'm not going to any damned meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous." She said, "Well, you'll be back there with me tonight, or I'll put you over there where the doorknobs are on the outside of the doors." If you've never been in a nut house, they have architectural defects in them. Some doors have one knob, it ain't on your side. And I said, "Well, I guess I'll have to go. But I ain't no damned alcoholic." She said, "Maybe you could be wrong about that." Ain't that a hell thing teller? And a drunk with 7 days sober, you could be wrong. Alcoholics are never wrong. None that I ever knew. I heard a story, and strangely enough, Billy Moore told me this story. So I know it's true. I didn't think it was true, I wouldn't tell you. From up here. Marguerite Hughes said, "Maybe you could be wrong about that." And Billy told me a story about alcoholics are never wrong, about an old cowboy out west that come out of the saloon one day drunker in hell, and an old man rode in town on a mule, and that drunken alcoholic cowboy, when that old man got off that mule, he went out and grabbed him and said, "Hey, old man, can you dance?" And old man said, "No, I don't know nothing about dancing." That alcoholic cowboy said, "I bet you can." And he got that six shooter out and started shooting at that old man's feet, and that old man got to dancing. But he was counting them bullets. And when that alcoholic fired that sixth bullet, that old man reached up on the back of that mule and got a shotgun. He stuck it up in that alcoholic's face, and he said, "Did you ever kiss a mule's ass?" He said, no, but I've always wanted to. No, but I've always wanted to. Damn if I'll admit I'm wrong. That's the story of my life. Well, I had to go back at meeting that night. That nurse come got me by my earlobe and took me down a corridor to a student nurse's classroom, and I didn't want to go. I was madder than hell. I'd been in there a week, and I met a young alcoholic lady in there, and we'd kind of fallen in love in that week's time, and I was physically better, and they had a square dance, and she was going to the square dance. Her psychiatrist didn't believe in AA, and she was going to the square dance, and I wanted to be with her. I think that's the most interesting thing in the world, even today, to see two drunks in love in a nut house. Hey, but you see it all the time. You know? They walking down them corridors holding hands and blinking eyes at each other, and they can't wait till they get out of there, and sometimes they don't wait till they get out of there. You know? The only thing I know it's dumber than that is people that work in there try to separate them. I'm serious. If you work in one of them joints and you got two drunks in love, you leave them alone. Encourage them to stay together. Really. If you separate them, it'll screw up four people. They're just meant for each other. Well, back I go. Nurse got me by my earlobe. Now, this is embarrassing to 33-year-old macho wino from 4th and Central. And she's got me by my earlobe and takes me to a door, and an old lady was standing in that door. You couldn't get in that student nurse's classroom, one little door, and in that door stood a gray-haired lady, beautiful lady. And I've often said, next to my wife, I have never met anybody I ever loved more than Margaret Bivin. She was a doll, and later became as good a friend as I ever have or expect to have. And she had the most beautiful smile. She was about 60 years old at that time. I was 33, and Marguerite Hughes had me by the ear, and she says, Marguerite, this is Jack Sullivan. He wants to come to your AA meeting tonight. I said, she's a damn liar. I don't want to come to your AA meeting. She made me come back here. And Marguerite put her arm around my shoulder, and she says, now, honey, she said, honey, why don't you have a cup of coffee and a cookie? Now, ain't that a hell of a thing to offer a drunk from 4th and Central? A cup of coffee and a cookie. I'd been in there about a week. I was feeling good. I was ready for a half pint and a hooker. And she wanted to give me a cup of coffee and a cookie. Well, I went in there and sat down, and an old fellow named Brownie Sayers was the first AA speaker I ever heard. And he was talking that night, and I interrupted him. I made an ass out of myself in that meeting you wouldn't believe. They tried to shut me up, and I wouldn't shut up. I was flying high on that Valium anyway. You know, and it was pitiful. And Brownie and I have often laughed about it years later. And he just kept on talking. But I did. I made an ass out of myself you wouldn't believe. And when it was over, I started out that door, and there stood that damned old woman. And she grabbed me and put her arm around my shoulder, and she said, now, honey, you come back next week. Alcoholics Anonymous needs people like you. I thought, they ought to put that old broad in a home. So. Get her off of the street. You don't do things like that and they need you? They're crazy. Well, you roam around that hospital for a week and had those sessions, you know, group, and you listened and whatever, and then they made you go back the following Tuesday. So I went back the following Tuesday, and I walked in that room, and I sat down next to an old man, And there was a guy up there behind the desk, and little did I realize that night, those two men were to change my life in a way that I never dreamed possible and didn't even know them. I sat down there and flopped in that seat, and that old man's name was Hillary Sanders, and the fellow behind the desk was named Jim Kershon. And Hillary looked at me and said, "How you doing, boy?" That's all he ever called. He was boy. Yeah. And you never had a name when the last 2 years you drank. Your family called you It. You know, they do, you know. Look at it. Here it comes, you know. You get to AA and they call you boy. And that old man said to me, he said, "How you doing, boy?" Well, I thought, it really none of his damn business how I'm doing. I was serious. I didn't know him. I'd seen him the week before. Certainly he didn't have any impact on my life. What the hell did he care how I was doing? I thought, well, why don't you be nice to him? He's old. You know, you ought to be nice to old people. Boy, I really believe that tonight. I said, "I'm doing all right, old man, but I ain't no damned alcoholic." He said, "Really?" I said, "Really." And he's looking at me, and I'm sitting there. I could thread a sewing machine while it was running, you know. I said, "I ain't no damn alcoholic." He said, "Really?" I said, "Really." He said, "Well, if you ever find out what's wrong with you, you ought to do something about it. You look like hell." I thought, "Well, you know, well, you old son." Yeah. And old Jim Kershon just sitting up behind that desk laughing. You know, Jim was a very gentle man. Hillary was a crass old buzzard. You know, he really wasn't. And I've often said, even today, I think everybody ought to have two sponsors. I got a young boy I'm sponsoring now, and I tell him, "I've got to find you a soul saver. Every newcomer needs an ass kicker and a soul saver." And I had one of each. And Jim just laughed when he'd chew me out. And so I went back the third week and the fourth week, and finally they had sent me to, the only alcohol treatment union in the state of Kentucky was in a nut house in Hopkinsville, Kentucky. They had an alcoholic ward there. It was the only place in the state of Kentucky that treated an alcoholic for being an alcoholic. And it was a strange place in a way, you know, you can imagine on the grounds of an insane asylum. And they say alcoholics have low self-esteem. I guess that's true, but I guarantee you when you left there, you did. And it was because those insane people didn't want you. I mean, I'm serious. You'd walk around the grounds and you'd hear them talking about them drunks they just brought there the year before. "Put them up on Ward 19, didn't they, Martha?" "Yeah." "What in the hell did they bring them here for?" "Uncle George was a drunk. Bunch of damn troublemakers is all they are. Why the hell don't they take them somewhere else and leave us alone?" I mean, you get low self-esteem when insane people talk about you like that, you know. And they really didn't want you. Yeah. And they tried, you know, they tried to get you to change. And I didn't have any intention of changing. A fascinating thing took place in my life at that time. And so many times I don't talk about this. I had a lot of trouble with God when I come in AA for the simple reason I'd listen to people tell about what God did for them, and I couldn't understand why he did things to other people. I had a friend lost two teenage children in a car wreck. They both died. And I hear people talk about God saved their kids, you know. And God gave them sobriety. And my cousin died from alcoholism. And God helped them with this and helped them with that. And yet, you know, it was such a difficult thing for me to understand. Why did these people die, you know? And then there was a guy in there whose name was James Moynier, and he had been in AA. He had lost an insurance agency, a big insurance agency in Louisville, and Hillary Sanders and Bill Wallace had got a hold of Jim and got him in AA, and he stayed sober for 3 or 4 years, got his agency back, was doing wonderful, and got drunk again. And he lost that agency, and he had a broken leg, he was hit by a car, and he was in Western State Hospital with me. And he would sit there day after day after day and try to tell me the wonderful things about Alcoholics Anonymous. and how what they had done for him, and how he wished he had stayed, and what happened to him when he left. He said, for God's sakes, Jack, change your damned attitude and the way you think and the way you act. And let AA work for you, and let AA help you, because it can and it will. I'm a classic example that it can and it will. And when I got out of that hospital on Saturday night, I was at Preston and Broadway at an AA meeting. We heard sirens coming from all directions, and somebody ran out the door and said, somebody's been hit by an automobile out there in the middle of that intersection at Preston and Broadway. And two or three people, including me, went out there, and it was Jim Moynier laying in the middle of the street dead. And he'd gotten out of that hospital and went back to drinking. And I'm sure he was headed to the AA meeting. And you know, and I know that I never met anybody more determined to stay sober in my life than he was, just from the way that he talked, but he died. You know, and that was a hard thing for me to understand. And through the help of an old guy in AA and a chaplain at Lady of Peace Hospital, I was able to understand the God that I can understand. That there's no negative side to God. Somebody asked Bishop Sheen one time to define God, and that's a difficult thing to do. And Sheen said that God was the intangible spirit of truth that lives in the hearts of people. Intangible spirit of truth. Whether there is a God or isn't a God is not the point in Alcoholics Anonymous. The point is you're a better person because you believe there is. It does nothing for God for you to believe in him, but it does everything for you. And what that intangible spirit does for people like me is make me just simply understand that whatever I need to live in the world will be given to me. And there's always two sides to a lot of those stories, but none of them are negative. You know, if you put two men in a hospital with the same illness, the same age, the same families and everything, and one of them lives and one of them dies, the person who lives might stand behind this podium thanking God for God allowing him to live. And the guy who died, his families are thanking God for giving them the strength to accept his will and his decision. And there's no negative side to that concept. And the greatest thing in the world for people like us is, if that's what we want to believe, that's okay. If the person whose God saved the kids' lives in the car wreck, they want to thank God, that's great. And the person that lost the kids in the car wreck said, if that's God's will, that's okay. And it's the most fascinating thing in the world when you can understand that kind of concept in your heart of a spirit. And that was the greatest thing in the world for me, because I was so bitter about Jim dying. And in a way, it was a wonderful experience, because one night at an AA meeting, and I had not told this story in years, and as things happening here, a lady was sitting in the audience and tears running out of her eyes. She was crying. And when the meeting was over, she came up and hugged my neck, and it was his daughter. And I've spoken at her last three AA birthdays. And I met the mother of his wife. So it was a great experience for me in that hospital, you know, because of that man. And because of his experience, what it gave me is a tremendous and great understanding of what people are talking about, a God concept as they understand it. But anyway, I left that hospital, and I came back to Louisville and went to live with a sister of mine. And the whole deal was set up. Hillary Sanders and my father set me up like a boarding house pie. Yeah. I got out of that hospital, and it was around Thanksgiving. You know, and I think about it every time I was in there, right in November. Thanksgiving's kind of a strange time. We never eat Thanksgiving dinner at home. We always go out and eat it. Somebody asked me, why do you do that? And I said, well, Gay and I are very sensitive, both of us, very sensitive people. We get emotionally involved stuffing a turkey. But my father got some clothes for me to wear where I looked decent, and on Tuesday night he come to the house and picked me up, took me to dinner, him and my stepmother, and took me to our Lady of Peace Hospital for that Tuesday night AA meeting, dropped me off and told me Hillary would bring me home. And Hillary brought me home, and he said, tomorrow night's Wednesday, you're going to the Outland group with me. I'll pick you up. You'll be out here in the driveway at 7 o'clock. I went with him, and he dropped me off, and he said, tomorrow night's Thursday night. Leo Schoenbacher will pick you up in here at this driveway at 7 o'clock, and you're going to the Bethlehem meeting. Leo dropped me off, and he said, be out in the driveway tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. George Spencer's going to pick you up, and you're going to the Gateway group. George Spencer dropped me off in the driveway, and he said, you'll be out here tomorrow at 7 o'clock. Hillary's going to pick you up, and you're going to Preston and Broadway. And I thought, what in the hell do they think that's all I have to do? I mean, there was other things occurring in my life, and I'm sitting there that Saturday thinking, they're crazy as hell. They think I'm going to do this every night. I mean, there was important things to do, watch Yogi Bear or something, you know. But anyway, I was ready for him, and he whipped in that driveway, and I said, listen, get in the car. I said, listen, I have get in the damn car. I said, but you don't understand. He said, get in the damn car. Well, I got in that damn car. 365 days the first year I was sober. Now, trust me, 90 meetings in 90 days is treatment center jargon. It ain't sponsor jargon. People ask me today, how do you stay sober? I said, don't drink, go to meetings, get in the car. That'll do it. Well, I rolled along, not changing a whole hell of a lot. Still hadn't done anything. Listen to them talk about me. They wouldn't let you say nothing. There was no discussion meetings, all speaker meeting. You listen, you know, and you didn't have anything to say. You didn't know nothing. A guy asked me a question one night, and I said, well, you know, in my opinion, and Hillary stopped dead in his tracks and come back to me and said, would you tell him? I said, I was just telling him that in my opinion. He said, who in the hell would be interested in your opinion? Well, what hurts is you can't think of anybody. But they taught you to change. They firmly believe nothing changed till you change. They taught you the steps. Nothing changed till you did the first one. You know, till you admitted and done something with that unmanageable life. I got a young fellow that I sponsor now, been sober 5 months, called me up the other night, wanted to know what I thought about step four. I said, I think it's wonderful. He said, what about me doing it? I said, after the first one. You know, I said, you still got a hell of an unmanageable life. We'll worry about that if you get past that one. You know, and I learned to do that with them. I learned to change with them. I learned to accept the second step of, hey, how insane and crazy that I was. You know, and I also learned that in the third step of Alcoholics Anonymous, I could turn my will and my life over to God, and I damn sure had better turn it over to somebody. I wasn't done too good at running it. I'd gone on for 8, 9, 10 months, and they wouldn't give me a big book. I asked Krishan for one. He said, ask Hillary. Hillary said, you don't need one. People say, go to meetings, don't drink, read the book. They said, go to meetings, don't drink, get in the damn car. I said, George, what's his name's got a book? He's been sober 3 months and he's got a book. He said, you don't need a book. You get a book, you read. If you read, you think. It's bad. You stay with us and don't drink and you'll be all right. You'll change. You stay with us. Don't worry about that damn book. But finally, after a while, I don't recall when they gave me a book. And I saw you all do that, and I said to him, I said, I won't get me one of them things where you draw through the lines with it. I said, I see them people, they read that book, and they find something in there that pertains to them, and they draw a line through it. He said, what in the hell are you talking about? I said, I want one of them things that when you come to something in that book that pertains to you, you draw a line through it. He said, are you talking about a highlighter? I said, yeah, that's what they call them. And he said, well, let me get this straight now. You want something to draw through that line when you come to that something in that book that pertains to you? And I said, yeah. He said, get a 3-inch paintbrush. I've never owned a damn book in my life with a line drawn through it. I'm serious. Every time I thought about that, I had to laugh. Well, you know, I changed. I live with my sister and doing real well. And I met Gay, and her and I got married. And Hillary and Mary Louise and Charlie Crawwinkle sent her to Al-Anon. Hillary said, bring her up here. I told them we're getting very serious about her. They're all in the circle there, Jim and Hillary and Mary Louise and Charlie and Dee Dee Ray. And bring her up here. I said, what do I want to bring her up here for? We told you to bring her up here. Oh, that makes sense. When they told you. So I brought Gay up there, and they really, Charlie and Mary Louise took her it was on Tuesday, on Thursday night, they come by her apartment and got her and took her to Al-Anon. They really believed and knew, you know, if you're going to change your life and live that way, then you have to live it through the Al-Anon family groups and the AA. And so Gay started going to Al-Anon, I was going to AA, we got married, and we were doing well, and still are. I got my job back with that railroad in 1974. I was asked to start an alcohol and drug abuse program for the L&N Railroad. Big operation, 13 states. First time it was ever done in the state of Kentucky. I loved every minute of it. You know, set it all up through AA people all over the country. You know, we've done a lot of good work into getting treatment for that. You know, sometimes I'm going to get somebody to invite me to come and talk somewhere without carrying your own message, you know. I never cease to be amazed at professional people, how they talk about insurance companies destroying treatment. There's not an industry in the United States of America that's not self-insured. Every move that's made in treatment inside of an industry is made by benefit directors. All decisions are made there. And there are the people that say no, and there's reasons why they do that. And we knew it inside of the industries. We knew it was coming, we saw it coming, you know, and we knew it, and nobody else listened or nobody else cared. But anyway, it worked out real well for a long time. And I retired in 1988. I don't do nothing now, I'm good at that. If you ever want a seminar put on how to do nothing, give me a buzz. I love old Bum Phillips that used to coach the Houston Oilers. Somebody asked Bum one time when he retired, said, what do you do? And Bum said, I don't do nothing. And start that at noon. So I'm good. I'm a follower of Bum's philosophy, really. But I thoroughly enjoy it. Gay and I have had the best life in the world. We really have. And, you know, and I think it's because we don't pick at each other. You know, I leave her alone, she leaves me alone. I love her, she loves me, and we do our thing, and she does hers, and I do mine, you know. And it's just great. I mean, we're two mature people. Paul Keibler told me one time, mature people are those who know the difference between right and wrong and act accordingly. You don't have to be a mental heavyweight to figure that out. No, you just don't have to. We've had the best life in the world, you know, all because we stayed here and did what you told us. Didn't drink, went to meetings, got in the damn car, you know, and tried to help other people. Fascinating, greedy old fools like us. And I'm speaking for you when I say this, those of you who have been here for a while. Who among you ever thought that the greatest joy in your life would be in the eyes of some other human being? How fortunate we are, we've learned to love like AA taught us, you know. To love each other, boys or girls or whatever. We can say I love you with an understanding that I don't love you for what you are. I love you for what I am when I'm with you. I love you because of what I am when I'm around you. Because of you, I'm a much better human being. And hopefully in some small way, because of me, you're a better human being. There's one thing we know for sure. Because of each other, we're all better human beings. And we love each other for that. Love has many dimensions. But the kind you find in here is the love that we have for each other because of each other. It's just been a great life for me. Many years ago, a guy told me a story. I'll share it with you. I closed all my talks with it. It meant a lot to me. And over the years, it's meant a lot to other people that have told me, have called me. It was about a man who was walking down a very cold and lonely road one night. In the middle of the road laid a snake. And when the man passed the snake spoke to him. He said, Mister, please pick me up and help me. If you leave me here on this road, I'll die. I'm a reptile and cannot live in this kind of weather. Please help me. pick me up and put me under your coat and get me warm. And the man said, I can't do that. You're a poisonous reptile, and it's your nature to bite. And surely to God, if I pick you up and put me under your coat, when you get warm, you'll bite me. And the snake said, I won't bite you if you save my life. So the man picked him up from the road and put him under his coat, and when the snake got warm, he bit him. And the man grabbed the snake and threw him back to the road. And he looked at him and he said, I thought you promised if I helped you, you wouldn't bite. And with a snickering grin on his face, the snake looked at him and said, you knew what I was when you picked me up. My friends, if you're ever sitting somewhere in the confines of your own home, a cocktail lounge, a bar, wherever it may be, if it's your decision to take the cap off of the bottle or the cork out of the jug, explain it to those that care to listen. Rationalize it to those that are willing to hear. If you've been here, if you know me, if you've met us, you know what it is when you pick it up. Thank you for having me in Mount Eagle.